Welcome back to the Get Cyber Resilient Show. This week is our Behind the News episode. I'm Dan McDermott, your host for today, and I'm joined by our resident cybersecurity experts, Garrett O'Hara and Vin Yuan. Today, we will begin by looking into a false subscription callback scam from a group called Lunamoth. Next, we'll look into the latest attack on LastPass, this time accessing customer details. Then we'll continue our series of looking at another win for the good guys, this time with the arrest of nearly 1,000 suspects. And as always, we'll end with a wrap of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. Gar and Vin, welcome to episode 119. Let's start this week with diving into a callback scam that has been identified by Palo Alto's Unit 42 research group. What can you tell us about this one?
So I suppose first things first, not to be confused with Luna Lovegood from Harry Potter. This is a very, very different thing that's going on here. So this is an example of some approaches that have become much more popular, this idea of callback sort of scams or phishing attacks. The idea there is that you get the inbound phishing attack that arrives into an organization. They tend to be fairly well customized. So, you know, people get individual phone numbers to call back on. So the idea is that it's social engineering. The person gets the email. In this case, Dan, as you said, it's a, you know, fake subscription cancellation, just under $1,000 on average. And then, you know, the person is social engineered. They panic. They call a phone number that's set up by the attack crew. And then from there, they essentially go and use well-known tools, so legitimate tools to exfiltrate the data. And they do it in a couple of different ways. They either look for data straight away and see if they can get some stuff out immediately, so using things like FTP. But they can also get it set up so that as they get the remote support session going, which is part of this, by the way, so that, you know, when you call back the number, they help you. And to do that, they get a support session going. And anyone who's used, you know, TeamViewer, LogMeIn, you know, those kind of tools will be very familiar with that. You know, we use one of those internally. But once they've got that control, they basically then can set up persistence and a remote access tool as well. And at that point, then they can obviously spend longer, look for more stuff and essentially exfiltrate the data. The big thing here is there's no encryption. And I think we're starting to see more and more of that, right? You know, they're not using any dropped malware. Files aren't getting locked up. Systems aren't getting locked up. They're basically just getting the data out and then using the threat of it being published as the, you know, the thing to get the ransom paid.
And it really does show that notion of, you know, multi-vector sort of attacks, right? Like we've spoken about for a while, but like really coming to the fore. And that sophistication, like you say, of not only like is this, you know, sort of, I guess your standard email-based approach, but they're investing into like call center infrastructure and you know, remote access infrastructure and all of these sort of things to actually sort of build out, you know, I guess, you know, the sophistication and their offering, if you like, because we probably will see this as a service callback scam, you know, scam offering as well that others might be able to tap into.
Oh, yeah, I think we're already at that point, I would say, and you're spot on. I think the interesting thing always is that large investments in things like call centers and infrastructure to support these attacks. This isn't new, by the way. I used to work for one of the companies, actually, I just mentioned many, many years ago, which was an incredibly good tool, like phenomenal, brilliant use in legitimate organizations for supporting their customers. And the bane of our lives was the amount of fraud that was used. It actually became synonymous, unfortunately, at one point, the tool that we sold with these scams where, you know, you get, at the time, it was basically you jump on a machine and then use the remote session to do things like sign up to subscriptions or steal credit card information was the big one. You know, we're going to check your machine because we've detected a security issue. and these characters were, you know, pretending to be or legitimate organizations like Microsoft, you know. So, you know, brands jacking very well-respected brands to get that social engineering in place to then have somebody connect. And unfortunately, they were quite often older people, not technical people. And the brilliant thing with many of these legitimate tools is that they're designed to be easy to use for people who are not tech-savvy, like remote support tools. They're designed to connect to, I don't know, like the front desk or the, you know, the people whose jobs is not to be sort of tech-savvy. The downside of that is then it becomes incredibly easy to attack people who are not tech savvy because It takes 2 seconds. You point them at a URL, you give them a 6-digit code, and then that's it. You're basically connecting to their machine. So, yeah, to your point, Dan, like this stuff has been around a long time. I think the interesting thing to me is that investment in call centers, you know, these people will have done ROI analysis, you know, and they're so similar to legitimate business. It's not like they're going to do this for fun. They will do it because there is a return on investment. So, you know, kitting out and fitting out these call centers with, as you say, the supporting infrastructure, machines, voice over IP services, sending services for email, all of that good stuff, and the people. You know, you got to pay the staff, and you know, there's probably an employee of the month competition, and there's probably a employee engagement department, and HR probably has all of that stuff. And also on the dark side, and you know, not to go on too much about this, but we have seen those stories, unfortunately, where people are sort of tricked into working in these places, and then you know, that's a much darker version of the call centers that are used by the crooks in these cases.
Yeah, indeed. And as you say, it's really interesting that then they're being able to extort the data. And then really, what's the threat back is what? That they're going to publish that? Or is it, are they stealing sort of, you know, still personal information? What is it that they're actually getting out from these attacks?
I suspect it's a variety of different things, Dan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think about your machine, my machine, Vin's machine, There's things on there that I would certainly not be keen to have published, yeah, on the dark web or really anywhere. And yeah, like I suspect, given that the inbound phishing attacks are fairly well targeted, as I understand it, it's you know, it's going after people that potentially they already have identified as targets. So they may know that somebody's you know, working in a lab where potentially they've got information around, and you know, pending patents or some IP that means a drug company's stock price is about to go through the roof, or you know, like who knows. I think we're going to talk about a story a little bit later about you know, a sort of car, an organization that, you know, works in the car industry, and then some of their data that got stolen. So you know, I think you throw a dart at the average machine in a corporation, there's probably going to be something of value on there. And then I think when you're better at darts and you can target the bullseye of, you know, the people who have the IP or the information around payment or strategy for an organization, then all of a sudden that's stuff that you definitely don't want to get published in the dark web or anywhere else.
Yeah, indeed. And we said that, like, Palo Alto's research group, obviously have called it out, and I think named the group like behind it and that sort of thing. So certainly sort of calling that out. But as Mimecast, we've also seen like a lot of these emails come through, right? And actually seen, I guess, that front end of the actual email part and the scam coming through. And something that, you know, is something that I guess we're very aware of, and certainly want to make sure that like all of our customers and that are also, you know, very, you know, cognizant of and understanding what is happening in this space and what can be done about it.
Spot on, Dan. It's funny, one of our colleagues here, Nish, who's a pretty awesome guy, actually works at our kind of UK team, kind of raised this internally. And I think I might have even mentioned this in one of our internal meetings, but this, you know, the callback, the spam variations that our threat teams are tracking, as I'm sure many kind of cyber vendors are. But it's one that we're kind of constantly on the watch for, and you know, as relevant and appropriate, we'll, you know, add protection. As have Palo Alto, by the way. You know, they call that out in their write up that their customers are protected. So I think, you know, to me, it points to the value of threat research teams within cyber vendors, and that idea that instead of each individual customer having to write their own block rules, you know, that happens at a vendor level rather than at the customer level, which I think is incredibly important. And the other part, and it's probably stating the bleeding obvious at this point, but it's the value of awareness training. Like time and again, it is the humans that are the, you know, the human firewall. I think people are starting to hate that expression because it gets so used so often, but you know, you think about it in this case, awesome to have the technical controls in place, but if we've got a set of employees who are well trained to say, hang on a second, what, you know, what subscription service? I'm not even part of that. You know, why would I be getting this email? And, you know, if they even think it may be legitimate, raise it with the security team and let them have a look at it, and they will quickly identify that this is a scam.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. And one that's not on the run sheet for today, but actually I've got one overnight. From Amazon, and it was saying, I got an email saying that somebody had downloaded a gift voucher that was offered to them. The thing is that this employee had left a while ago, the gift voucher from the start of the year. I'm sort of like, my memory's fading me, right? It's possible that we did something, but it's got their email address as like their internal one, which obviously they don't have access to anymore. So I'm like, this feels wrong. And then not long after, I got another email from Amazon saying, watch out for these type of scams, and actually have outlined it and detailed sort of what's happening in that. So it was like, but it felt very, very real. And with all the detail in there, felt like this is something that, like, you know, actually feel pretty legit. So you've got to, it's like the way that they come across and the sophistication, and that it's so easy to feel like, and particularly, you know, if you're busy and under time pressure and all those things that we know, it's so easy to just go, oh, that looks about right. I better do something about this, right? Like, and then bang, as soon as you've taken that first step, then all the bad things sort of, you know, flow on from there. So definitely, I think, like you say, Gar, that notion of sort of, you know, people having to take that moment, and it can be just that moment to just reflect and just go, something's not quite feeling right, is probably enough to stop a lot of this as well.
And on that, Dan, not to go down the bunny trail of this stuff too far, but, you know, one of the things I've heard time and again is there's more of an onus on organizations to make sure that their comms look really legitimate. Because interestingly, I've heard some stories where the legitimate stuff looks so sort of shonky that actually it's you know, we talk about this the other way around, where we talk about how, you know, good the attackers have gotten. And yeah, I've heard this problem where third party, you know, sort of organizations are sending out comms, legitimate comms to their customers, and often where they're using like some sort of SaaS platform and legitimate domain spoofing to send on their behalf. And then you get these emails that don't look anything like the normal comms from that brand. So it's something for you know, cyber leadership as they work with their marketing brothers and sisters to think about, is that, you know, if you're going to use those third-party sending services, then, you know, really have a think about how to make the branding consistent so that it's not jarring for the end users when they do get something that they should maybe action, and it is consistent, because I think that inconsistency, actually, that's a, you know, it's sort of a vulnerability for organizations.
Yeah, and in my example, like the second email I got from Amazon, I was looking at that, reading it, going, is this from them? Because, I mean, it looked exactly the same as the first one, and I'm like, oh my goodness, like, and it's got a whole bunch of links in that, and it seems really legitimate, and it talks about, you know, the type of scam, and I'm thinking, is this like a follow-up to the first one, or is this legit? It just, you get into this mindset of, and, you know, and obviously then you just don't click anymore, right, and always type in links and that sort of thing, but it is like very, very easy to just to get into that spiral of which one's real, which one's not, and how do you actually really decipher? And, you know, you've got to feel sorry for people that, you know, aren't looking at this every day, right, and would be, you know, other prime targets of these attacks as well. Well, we'll move on to our next story, which is a new breach detected by the password management company LastPass. We featured this story a few months back about how their source code and technical systems had been breached. It now appears that the insights gained from that breach have been used to access some of their customer data this time around. So, Vin, what can you tell us about this case?
It tells us the fact that cyber security companies like LastPass can be targeted, and it kind of has a flow-down effect where, you know, anyone else can be a target of these things coming through. And the fact that in August we had source code and technical information being accessed, but not customer info, and now all of a sudden, you know, LastPass and GoTo's parent company are saying, hey, we've detected some unusual activity with the third-party cloud storage that we use. It's always fair and safe to just assume breach. So what they've done is they've launched an investigation. They've engaged Mandiant, who they actually used for their previous breach back in August, to kind of figure out the extent and what exactly has happened. The CEO said that, you know, even though this is all happening, customers' passwords still remain safe encrypted. And this is largely part to LastPass's zero knowledge architecture, which I think is fantastic, right? And it kind of leads to other stories where, well, if you're assuming breach and everyone's vulnerable and a potential target, if you don't have that information data on hand, there's not much they can get from there as well. So the fact that these passwords are stored locally rather than within LastPass's infrastructure, sure, they might get some information on customers' information, but the big thing which LastPass holds, which is your master password, isn't there. So I'd be curious to figure out what information they've got from that and what they will do with the information. But for the most part, you know, our master passwords are safe. Therefore, the rest of our passwords should theoretically be safe too, right?
You kind of wonder, like, does this link back to what we just talked about? Where, like, that question, Van, of, like, what's it useful for? Customer details is, you know, name, address, email address. And, like, that's the thing I worry about is the day I do get it. So I'm a customer of LastPass in this period of transparency. Awesome product, and I think makes me sleep better at night, knowing that I don't know any of my passwords. That's a wonderful position to be in as I get to my, you know, my later twilight years, not having to remember all of these passwords is fantastic. But the point you made there, Van, is so critical, right? That zero knowledge approach. The way the sort of PKI works is that they don't know what my passwords are. So it doesn't really matter if they get breached. There's not really a whole lot anyone can do to do with the data that they have got, which is, you know, customer details. I suspect what you might see is some version of phishing attacks where it's your master password has been compromised, you know, please confirm here, blah, blah, blah. And then, I mean, that's the thing that would keep me awake at night is somebody getting my master password, which is very long and sort of easy to remember. But, you know, if they figure that out for, you know, in some way, then, you know, that's game over.
I think you're right. I like that notion of like, this is the thing now, LastPass, like you say, Vin, you tell us that, you know, everything's safe, it's all okay, but you can't help but have that sort of sinking feeling in your gut that like, oh, is everything all right? Is there something wrong here? And then if you get an email from LastPass saying, oh, we just need to confirm, you know, it's very easy for people to go, oh, I better click on that one. I better make sure it's right. I better update that. It's like, that's where I think it's, you know, that all of a sudden the trust in the brand, like you say, the product may be working, but is the trust in the brand starting to become like questionable? Because it's like, well, geez, these guys have been in the news twice now. Like, am I okay? Do I need to change something? Very likely for many people to be thinking about.
And that's probably the sentiment, right? And, you know, we work in technology, we work in cybersecurity, we understand the value proposition that the likes of LastPass do have. But you're right, if you talk to anyone that is not in the space on the street and they hear about this password manager being breached, then of course it's going to raise concerns for them. They're going to be, and that's half the battle with getting people to use password managers, in my experience anyway, is that their ideas, I have one password that has access to everything. What if they get access to that password? And that is deterrent in them in using one. I know, Guy, you mentioned in the past, it's like friends don't let friends not use password managers. I love that. I've used that so many times already.
It's so true. Here's sort of a funny story. Somebody who I care about deeply uses a password manager. And guess what they do? They basically store like three variants of the same password that they create themselves in LastPass. And I'm like, oh, that is so not the point. I think, Dan, what you've raised is like actually really an important point here, right? Because part of this is understanding an architecture that's probably, let's be honest, like beyond the average kind of civilian on the street. You know, it's about encryption and, a sort of an architecture that is secure. I mean, there's no such thing as perfect security, right? You have to sort of asterisk everything you say these days with that. I get that. But as an architecture, like at least on the surface of it, it sort of works for me. And, when I see the LastPass stories hit, as they have a couple of times now, so far I haven't had that just sort of run out of the building, freaking out that my online life is sort of crumbling around my ears. It actually just feels like, okay, well, we'll see what data has been stolen. But like, I feel okay about the password side of things. Plus, no matter what, this has to be a safer version than, you know, using the same password or, you know, two variances of the same password everywhere. Regardless, even if they got my master password, they would have to then like literally go work through a long list of accounts that I've got in there, and every single password is unique. So they, you know, they need to go and reset or attack those. So like, there's no keys to the kingdom, even when you get the master password.
Exactly. So it's like you say, I think it's I guess it is partly now on, you know, LastPass and other providers of this to make sure that is understood, right? Like that the value of it is understood so that then you don't have all of those, you know, all of those concerns. Like, you know, you said, Vin, of, you know, most people go, oh, well, I've only got one. That doesn't sound very good. So I better not have that, right? Like, and so therefore step away from it. So there's definitely an education in this space that needs to be done around this. And then, you know, these things don't help in that education, right? Because they create fear, uncertainty and doubt in people's minds. So definitely a tricky one, but one that I think we'll continue to espouse the benefits of, that's for sure.
And it gets you thinking as well. It's like today, this is where we're at. But then what is the future of passwords in general? I mean, we're going from state here. And this is a fun question, Garen Daniel. What do you think is the most commonly used password here in Australia? It ranges from different sources, but there are a couple there. I'm pretty sure we can guess it on the pod today.
Like password 123 seems to come up all the time.
I think it's a password 1234 guy, like, you know, like getting really sophisticated.
Oh, yeah.
Now.
So that's complexity.
Well, I was reading something from NordPass, and apparently top two, number one was 123456. And second is just password. They didn't bother with the numbers. It was just password.
We got even too sophisticated there.
So here's where my head goes on that is that we have there's an obligation, I would say, on the provider side to check for that kind of nonsense and say, forget about it. Like, you like have a dictionary lookup of the obvious stuff like password 123, you know, those things, like, let's just not use them. I mean, that's a pretty trivial thing to implement.
Yeah, you see most you know, things these days say, you know, they have to have a degree of complexity and all of that in it, right? So you would hope that that becomes at least a minimum default standard. Let's have a look at our final deep dive story for this week, which looks at the arrest of nearly 1,000 cyber criminals and seizure of $130 million in virtual assets. The international law enforcement response to cybercrime has certainly stepped up and escalated in 2022.
Yeah, it definitely has. I think is this a Christmas miracle? It definitely feels like a good news story. We're kind of, I don't know about you guys, we're slowly burning our way through all the Netflix and Stan Christmas movies that basically have the same script and you just swap out the actors and, yeah, it gets hilarious. But this feels like it could be a nicer Christmas movie, you know, if somebody could figure out how to make this a rom-com. Nearly $130 million in virtual assets taken down with this stuff or retrieved. I think that's a really good news story. And then they've arrested nearly 1,000 people. Which I think is phenomenal. So it's Interpol's Operation Hashi. I don't know how you say that word, H-A-E-C-H-I, but it was a 5-month exercise that they were running. Long list of countries. I don't know if you guys saw the Interpol sort of landing page where they went through this, but like a long list of countries involved, and it ran from June to November this year. So fraud investigators around the world looking at sort of intercepting, obviously cash and money, but then also the kind of virtual assets that these criminals and scammers kind of get, you know, through money laundering, sextortion, romance scams. Like, there's been a bunch of things, online gambling. So, you know, all the fun stuff, unfortunately, they're kind of like having to go at. But yeah, like it's a pretty impressive, I would say, sort of outcome. And I think it really, the thing that gives me sort of, I suppose, hope is the level of cooperation that actually happened here across, you know, multiple kind of jurisdictions and regions. I think that is just incredibly heartening. And the fact that they're starting more and more to be able to track and block funds, because I know we've, you know, over the how many years we've been doing this pod, one of the things that's consistently come up is just how difficult it is when you've identified a crime to actually go after the funds and the cash, you know, to either block it or to retrieve it. In this case, it sounds like through this this collaboration and, you know, like nearly 30 countries involved, that they were able to actually retrieve funds. I think this is, yeah, just incredibly good news.
And it's definitely the tightening of both ends of the spectrum, right? Like we talk a lot about prevention and how do you stop the things in the first place. But we know that, you know, like the unrelenting nature of the attacks and, you know, the continued evolution of sophistication and everything else, that, you know, it's not stopping, right? And so it's like prevention's one part, but obviously this part in terms of actually the law enforcement side of actually coming in at the back end and being able to actually, you know, be able to find people, find the funds, prosecute, is a huge, then becomes a huge deterrent as well. So you hope that the two things combined really do make for, you know, better outcomes as we go forward. But yeah, it's certainly at a different scale and level than, you know, we've spoken about a few good news stories recently, off the back of all the sort of the bad news and that. And, you know, we've had 30 people and 60 people and bang, all of a sudden you've got 1,000 people sort of, you know, implicated into this one sort of investigation. So huge effort. And it certainly, I think, should give some confidence, you know, that there is that back end law enforcement support that is there and available as well. And so hopefully that becomes a deterrent as well as the prevention. And like I say, we hopefully move forward in a better way.
Agree. Drop the hammer of the law, I think, yeah. And to your point, Dan, I mean, that I really like the way you just put that, because I think whatever about the protections against the stuff, the deterrent is actually really important too. And you know, that you know, we talked about the ROI and setting up call centers and infrastructure. Like, if you start to see some of that money kind of getting siphoned back away, it changes the math, right? I mean, it does deter, because it stops being worth it, you know? So I think to your point, it's actually a really important part of this. Good news that everyone got their money back, but I think there's a longer term impact, which is hopefully it deters people who otherwise would have a go, saying, well, actually, it's probably not worth it.
And we're also talking about Interpol as well, right? And I didn't know it was so big. I thought it was a few countries involved, but I looked at close to 200 countries. So although this particular sting was, you know, 30 or so, having the law involved and making it, as you said, Dan, the deterrent piece, like, that's going to have huge flow down effects in terms of, like, is it going to be worth it for us if we know that X percentage is now able to be stopped and transferred to, you know, offshore accounts as well. So very interested to see, like, where this kind of leads to anti-money laundering rapid response protocol and kind of how that helps moving forward.
Indeed. Well, finally, let's wrap up with a quick review of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. The first news item is a breaking story on how energy provider AGL has reported that thousands of customer accounts have been unlawfully accessed. What's happened here?
I think this is quite still very early days in terms of what it is, but essentially from AGL in a statement, it's around their MyAccount platform experiencing some suspicious activity, which, you know, customers have been notified. It's in the thousands. I think I was reading it was about 6,000 or so at this time. It could grow. But really, as a precaution measure, what they did was they locked down the platform and they're now doing their due diligence in terms of figuring out what exactly has happened. It appears that malicious actors have stolen credentials quite externally, such as username and passwords, and using that to log into several of customers' accounts. And like most stories, it starts with credentials being harvested somewhere and using it to access a platform. So more of a stay tuned, and we'll keep our ears open to how this develops, but pretty big given AGL's, presence here in Australia.
I think it is. The interesting part is the fact that, like, username and password's been stolen from somewhere else in order to access it. Like, this just feels like the ongoing, never-ending saga through Optus and Medibank, right? And how this is now the next stage of the use of that data and what might happen from here. Which leads us to our next two updates on the ongoing sort of fallout from the Medibank breach. Firstly, the hackers have announced the notion of a case closed by dumping all the remaining customer data onto the dark web.
Yeah, I think this one sort of, it is what you just said. Basically, the hackers basically have done, like, they're done with it, it sounds like. So they put the remaining kind of data up in the dark web, and or at least what appears to be that, and then kind of said, well, that's it, you know, case closed for the hack. And I don't know, I think it'll be interesting to see you know, whether that is the case or not, and, you know, what the implications are, Dan. That's the other thing, as you said. I mean, this stuff gets used for other things. It's, you know, there ends up being a long tail of impact from these breaches, and yeah, I suppose that'll be the question. What does this mean? I think it was a compressed file that was just over 5 gigs, so reasonably substantial amount of data, whatever it was.
Indeed. And then the scrutiny on Medibank doesn't end. The breach has now prompted an intensifying look by APRA from a regulatory perspective on the cybersecurity around, Medibank and the rest of the industry. So, Vin, what's APRA looking at here?
It's looking exactly at that, Medibank Private. Given what has happened over the weeks, it's only fair that the likes of APRA being able to look into Medibank Private's data privacy practices and how they store and how they kind of use it, but actually kind of expanded more broad, to all APRA kind of regulated organizations. So we're talking to the likes of banks, insurance companies. Generally, if you're dealing in the financial space, you do fall under APRA, and therefore their prudential standard, which is CPS 234. So really, it's a review of that particular to make sure that we're introducing proper cyber resilience around things like banks, insurance, superannuation, and we're constantly retesting to notify if things do happen, that there's a certain kind of playbook to follow and to report up. But definitely it's going to be one of those cases that we're going to be talking about for a long time in terms of incident response, but also how that changes legislation, but also like things like CPS 234, what that means for other APRA regulated organizations.
I think this is an interesting one in that I think there's a pattern here. I was kind of thinking about this story caught over the weekend. I do have a life, but I do sort of, unfortunately, I think about this stuff a little bit too much. How many standards exist and how many certifications exist? And we kind of know what good looks like when it comes to security, but it's the push and the enforcement of that to get organizations doing the right thing. And CPS 234, before it was a standard, it was certain guidelines that APRA had. So it was kind of like, here, please go do these. These are good. You should do these. Because they're guidelines, they're obviously opt-in and it's not mandatory. And I think what you see is as this stuff becomes more and more important, the stakes get higher year over year. Guideline becomes a standard and it becomes not a, hey, look, you should go do this, but go do this. It becomes kind of an obligation and mandatory. And even then, not just with CPS 234, but I think it's fair to say, the essential aid or, look at a vertical, look at an industry, look at their standard and then look at the gaps. And the reality is that a bunch of organizations for lots of different reasons, whether that's the leadership that's in play or, availability of budget, talent, all of those things will be somewhere off. They won't be there. They'll be trying to get there, but they won't be there. And I think to Vin's point, I think that's like it. As awful as all this stuff has been, like the thing I keep trying to come back to is like, does this help us get the change that we need to in terms of seeing this stuff as really, really serious and really, really important for every organization to, look at? I think, the financial services in particular, given the very sensitive information that you provide to them and that they have access to, this seems like it's just kind of common sense in so many ways. Rant over.
And I think, though, it's also an opportunity for those that are not regulated by APRA to say, is this a gold standard? Is this, considering, banking and that industry of being sort of at that level, is it something that should be reviewed and looked at, in terms of how does everybody raise their own standard and get to another level? And we also see sort of, the deterrent coming in through the sort of the federal government's legislation around, the increase in fines that, come with not being able to meet certain standards. So, I think, again, it's the push and pull of some of these things to really look at, like you say, Gaurav, how to up-level and take the opportunity now to really get to those levels of cyber resilience and that new standard. Otherwise, the next time something goes wrong and there's a fallout, the implications, continue to get higher and higher. So finally for today, a story that Gar mentioned before around a German manufacturer in the car industry, Continental, have brought in the FBI to assist with an ongoing investigation into a data breach from August this year.
Continental, I'm not sure folks who maybe you know who that is. They're an automotive supplier out of Germany. And I think it's kind of an interesting one. There was an issue that had happened. And then, so I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Handelsblatt. which apparently was news to me, but it's a financial newspaper in Germany. Forgive my ignorance there, my German friends. But yeah, they sort of reported on that the FBI has been brought in. So I don't know what that points to, presumably the sort of involvement of folks outside of Germany. But what they were looking at was the investigation of theft of company data, you know, actually nearly full circle down back to, what are the things that would be of importance or of interest. But yeah, apparently there was some stuff around kind of strategy and, you know, the kind of business side of Continental that's had been exfiltrated. So obviously that's not amazing. If you're out there kind of going shoulder to shoulder and competing for business, and you certainly don't want your competitors aware of what your strategies and your thinking are for kind of your organization. So yeah, I think kind of an interesting one. For what it's worth, I use Continental tires on my road bike. So far, so good. They've been really good.
Good to hear. Well, I think that wraps up for this episode. Thank you, Gar and Vin. Appreciate your insights as always in another big week of cyber news. So until next episode, if you'd like to continue exploring key topics in cybersecurity, please jump on to getcyberresilient.com and check out some of the latest articles, including parts 2 and 3 in our series on securing Australia's cyber future, as well as a full wrap of the headlines from November in our This Month in Security article. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay safe.